Hey everyone, this is Ismay, musician, host, and creator of Finding Lucinda. In anticipation of our documentary film coming out this fall, I've put together an in-depth companion podcast. It delves into the origins and artistry of legendary singer-songwriter Lucinda Williams. New episodes are out every other week on the BGS Podcast Network. So join me on this creative journey.
Welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the bluegrass situation. It's Cindy, and guess who is here? Lizzie, no.
It's your girl!
Here we are, hanging with the girlies on Basic Folk.
Oh, Cindy, I miss you. We have so much to catch up on, so I hope our audience doesn't mind if we take some time to just catch up on each other's lives. I was with two incredible Basic Folk alumni last night, having the time of my life. Laughing, crying, clapping, the whole nine. It was my first time seeing a show at the Bluebird Cafe in Tennessee, the legendary Nashville music venue. And it was a writer's round hosted by the Irish singer-songwriter Pat Byrne, who I did not know, but I am now a big fan of. He lives in Austin. Really cool songs, really great voice, cool presence. And his special guests were Jamie Harris and Brian Dunn. And Brian had a new song out at midnight, so there were new songs being shared, there were stories being shared, just like three great, great, great singer-songwriters in the round. It really reminded me why I moved to Nashville, because like that is what this city brings out, you know, the great songwriters. And what's good with you? You are, by my count, 1 month out from being a mom.
At the time of this recording, yes. However, when this recording is released, it will have happened.
Oh my gosh. How are you feeling? How's Elizabeth feeling?
Everyone's feeling great. We just got a nursery chair delivered today.
Is it comfy?
Oh my gosh. We splurged. There's like, that's the thing that people are like, get a good one.
Yes.
Because you can get like a really affordable one. And this one was not bad. But
I have heard that because that is like going to be your comfort in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. Night after night. You need a good chair.
All right. So Tony Camel is on the podcast today. And before we get into Lizzie's conversation with Tony, I just want to remind you that if you would like to stay in touch with Basic Folk, the best way to do it is to sign up for our newsletter, which you can do at the link in the show notes, or you can go to basicfolk.com. You can also follow us on social media at Basic Folk Pod, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. No, not on Twitter. What is that? TikTok.
Goodbye, Twitter.
Goodbye. Or you can make a financial contribution and help with production costs so we don't have to start charging artists to appear on Basic Folk. Just kidding. We would never do that.
We would never do that. And guess what? We now have a baby to support. Think about that.
If you want to make a financial contribution, go to the link in the show notes or basicfolk.com/donate.
If you're listening to this episode as it comes out, it is summertime and I, Lizzie Noh, am potentially coming to a town near you on tour. I have tour dates in Illinois, South Dakota, Virginia, some festivals. I'm playing the North Carolina Folk Festival.
That sounds so fun.
A very fun summer for Lizzie Noh fans. So go to lizzienoh.com/tour. Get tickets, please. I'm really excited about these shows. And grateful that I still get to keep touring in the midst of this crazy world that we're in.
I also want to say congrats, Lizzie, for being mentioned. It's been a while now as this, we're recording this in May and this episode comes out in July, but congratulations on being featured on It's Been a Minute, talking about OnlyFans.
Thank you so much for bringing that up. I am really happy with how the original interview came out. For listeners that may not know, I am on OnlyFans now. It's a crowdfunding thing. It's a little bit adult and edgy. And there are some really cool aspects to that work that I was stoked to talk about and share my side of the story of. And this wonderful reporter, Isabella, has reported on it in NPR. And it's like an empowering way to tell a complicated story.
Amazing. Yeah, you can check that out in It's Been a Minute's podcast feed. I just want to say that Khan has disallowed nudity on the red carpet, so get on OnlyFans.
I think that that is wild and ridiculous because there is nudity in the films that are shown at Cannes. And it is obviously art and it is obviously beautiful and fine. And we are adults and we can choose to see nudity or not. So to outlaw a sheer dress on the red carpet, that is not okay. That is misogynist. We don't like.
No, hate.
Who has ever been harmed by seeing someone in like a sheer outfit? Can we be really honest? Like, I know this is like a family-friendly podcast, but who is harmed by seeing a nipple through a gown? It's just not a big deal. Mm. There's just way bigger fish to fry in this world. That being said, Tony Camel. I am overjoyed to introduce our audience to this wonderful singer-songwriter and human being. You may recognize Tony's voice and face and vibe from his acclaimed bluegrass group, Wood and Wire. But the focus of our interview was his two wonderful solo albums, We're All Gonna Live, just came out. And it is a realist optimist's guide to navigating a complex and often heartbreaking world. Like, there's something so encouraging about the songs, so humane, so empathetic. And it's rooted in bluegrass, but I found it to be like really well-rounded, contemporary country, folk, great singing, great songwriting, super fun album, even though it deals with some heavy topics. And one of the parts of the interview that like kind of was most thought-provoking for me was talking to Tony about the differences between being in a band versus being a solo artist. And how when he got into bluegrass, he really like just wanted to be able to gel with and collaborate with other musicians. And he was like, they let me hang out because I was a great singer. And then I started, you know, really figuring out the guitar. Well, he didn't say I'm a great singer, but it was like, you know, there's kind of a culture in bluegrass where you really want to be a picker. And he didn't want to show up and not have the goods. So he kind of had his voice as mm-hmm. his foot in the door. And then he just got to work and got all his skills up. And he says he's not a good guitarist still, but I really enjoy his playing on this album. And he's a dad. We talked about how being a parent changes everything, including being an artist. It's a really cool interview. And I'm excited for people to get to know Tony's solo material because it's really, really good.
Great. Well, let's take a listen to a song from the new record. This is one of my top songs of the year. Let's do Making It Work from Tony Camel. And then we'll get to our conversation with Tony and Lizzie No on Basic Folk.
Thank you so much for making the time to be on Basic Folk. We are fans and very excited to have you. My first question to you is, why do you write songs and then why perform them?
First of all, thanks for having me. I'm a fan as well, and I'm honored to be here.
Oh, thank you.
I don't know why I write songs. I kind of write songs, I feel like, because I have to, sort of. Mm-hmm. It's as a form of emotional and artistic expression. I don't write a lot of songs. I'm not one of those people that writes songs every day or even every week. I go months without writing anything. And mm-hmm. I think any songwriting book will tell you should write something every day. And I just don't do that. But I do when I feel like I have something I want to write about or I should write about. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I don't even really like writing songs. It's can be a struggle, or it's like I fight against my own weird insecurities or something. I don't really know how to explain it. Mm-hmm. But part of the why, frankly, is the answer to the next question. I write songs because I want to perform them and I like to perform for people. I just do. I love performing. I love being in front of crowds and expressing myself that way. Ultimately, to me, that's sort of the ultimate part of this whole thing is playing shows.
Have you always been a performer? Did you ever have stage fright? Were you born a ham?
I might have been born a little bit of a ham, but at some point as I was growing up, I definitely developed stage fright. And I didn't really get on mm-hmm. stage until later in life. And in the beginning of me performing music, I was definitely had really bad performance anxiety. And eventually I got over it. But I think it's because I wanted everything to be perfect. And I would fall apart at any little mistake. And I haven't played a single show since that time where I haven't made some kind of mistake. So
I make mistakes every single night. And it's actually mm-hmm. usually the more often I've performed a song and the better I know it, the more likely I am to forget the very important bridge lyric that people came to the show to see.
Every single time. Every single time.
That's going to be the one.
Uh-huh. Even when I know it's coming, I still mess it up.
That is the Zen cycle of being a performer. Okay. When and where did you first hear the call to bluegrass? And how did you answer?
I got into bluegrass late. I grew up in Houston, Texas, and not exactly a bluegrass mecca. But as I was growing up, I got into folk music old folk music like Towns Van Zandt and Texas artists that are sort of legendary in that way. And even Willie Nelson, you know. And that's kind of where I found the songwriting side of it. But then in high school, jam bands were a really big thing too. Fish, String Cheese Incident, all the typical ones from the late 90s, early 2000s. Mm-hmm. They played bluegrass songs in their sets. Even though I wasn't a big jam band head or a big Fish head, they played bluegrass songs in their sets, and those kind of spoke to me. And then when I got to college at University of Texas, I worked backwards. They have a big media art, a fine arts library with tons of music. And so I'd check out old Newport Folk recordings, and I got old recordings of Earl Scruggs and Ralph Stanley, and eventually Doc Watson is what hooked me in to try to learn how to flat pick.
So you were getting CDs and putting them on a computer?
Correct. Yeah. While I was studying, I'd dump CDs on my hard drive and then listen to them later.
I did the same. And in high school, I thought I was like getting away with something illegal. And maybe I was. I was like, I now own the entire Led Zeppelin catalog.
Yep.
So what was your first instrument? And how did it come into your life? Was it given? Did you choose it?
My mom had an old classical guitar in a closet, and I found it. It had a few strings on it, and I would mess around with it. I was probably 11 or 12. Mm-hmm. And I still have that guitar. I play it every day, almost. It sits on my couch, super accessible, something I can grab anytime. But I was, wanted to learn. I was like into Frank Zappa, Led Zeppelin, and Ozzy Osbourne. Mm-hmm. So for my 13th birthday, I got an electric guitar. And that was when I really started to dig in.
Oh. Did you ever take lessons, or are you self-taught?
I'm self-taught, but I wish I had taken some lessons early on. I was just so stubborn mm-hmm. that I didn't like to be told what to do. I still don't, and I still fight against that. But I wish I had stuck with piano lessons. I like took a few piano lessons when I was young mm-hmm. and I quit them so quickly. And I regret that.
What's your relationship like with practicing, even like teachers aside?
I go through bouts where I over practice. I think sometimes I like to practice, and bluegrass is what taught me to practice mm-hmm. because I could always sing. I could always sing. And here in Austin, where I live, there's some excellent bluegrass players. When I started to get into the scene, I couldn't really play, but I could sing. So I was allowed to be in, or I was welcomed into the sort of, I don't know, higher level picking circles because I could sing. But I wanted to be able to pick too. So I started practicing real hard. And then my old band, Wood and Wire, we formed before I was very good at playing guitar. I still am not that great of a flat picker, but during that time, I couldn't do any of it. So I had to catch up. And so it's the old adage, you surround yourself with people who are way better than you. And that's what I did. So I practiced really hard. And now I like to practice. And sometimes I get into these weird little cycles where I'm doing stuff that I'll probably never play on stage, but it's good exercise.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've led me into what was going to be my next question. How did the band Wood and Wire come together?
Essentially, we met here in Austin through the music scene. That's the most simple way to put it. But there was a Monday night bluegrass night at a place called Flipnotic's Coffee where the players in town would, it was a jam in a sense. It wasn't an open jam. It was like a performance jam. Like there was a mic in the middle. I think it's kind of like what they do at Mona's, you know, probably similar. Yes. Where they put together a band and then they perform traditional songs. And it doesn't matter who the people are, as long as they know the formulas, they can do it. So that's where I met the guys in Wood and Wire. And then eventually I went to the Old Settlers Bluegrass Festival where I got to know them better. Or Old Settlers Music Festival, I should say.
Yeah. I know those folks, nice people.
Yeah.
Are there aspects of how you show up as Tony Camel's solo artist that you feel like are inherited or borrowed from your Wood and Wire days? Like, how does it affect you as a solo artist to have been in that combination of people for so long?
I'm still figuring that out, honestly. I learned the value of being around really, really good musicians and working really hard on something. So when I play all by myself, I focus really hard on making that fun and compelling and not just another dude with a guitar. So I think
there are so many of y'all, respectfully.
I know. Thank God I play the banjo. There's a lot of dudes with banjos too. And I know you're absolutely right, Lizzie. There's so many of us. And that's in the back of my mind constantly. Like, how can I make it different? And I think part of Wood and Wire, that was a big part of our thing. We played a genre of music that has a specific formula, that has people who think it should only be that formula, people who think it should be way outside. And we really tried, and it happened pretty naturally, to make our own version of it, make it unique, make it compelling, and make it something that people who like bluegrass music and other types of music were going to enjoy because it was different and unique and our own. And so that journey I'm still on as a solo artist as well.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, when I have a full band and I'm playing under my own name, it's not really bluegrass. Like there's drums, electric guitar and stuff like that.
We won't tell anyone.
Okay.
What was your vision when you started recording Back Down Home? Like, did you have an idea of this is what I want to sound like as a solo artist and this is why I'm making a solo record?
That's a good question because I was trying to figure that out and I had a lot of help from Bruce Robinson, the producer.
Mm-hmm.
And we basically went into that studio, the bunker. It's an all analog studio, and a few of the musicians that were in there with me I knew really well, and a few of them I'd never met. And I never really worked that way for something I was so dedicated to, so I was a little nervous. But we sort of found, I had a lot of questions around what this was going to be, and we kind of found it together, and it was exciting. It was kind of like when you're getting together with the band. And someone introduces a song and you kind of don't know exactly what the arrangement's going to be, but then you find it and it gets really exciting. And there's that emotion and feeling you get when it hits.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we were chasing in that session. And we were trying to find that and then ride that wave while we had it. And yeah, it's all live. You know, I didn't re-sing anything. And a lot of the people, everybody was in the same room for that one. We did overdubs and stuff, but my vision for that was just to make something cool And I think we accomplished that, but it was definitely different than I had in my head in the beginning than it was at the end.
Yeah, it's a cool record. And I've noticed on both of your solo records, there are a lot of like very tactile moments and snatches of conversation that remind you that what you're listening to is a recording of particular people playing particular instruments in a particular space. So why is it important to you to include whatever improvisation, specificity, spoken word, I don't even know what to call it, but you know what I'm talking about. Those little sure. like situational details that you could edit out, but it seems like you very intentionally keep certain ones in.
I call them peeks behind the curtain.
There you go.
I like that stuff. You know, I included it because I like that stuff. It's my preference. It's my taste.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said earlier, I don't really like being told what to do. And that's not a huge part of my personality, but when I was becoming a musician or trying to figure out who I was, I found peace and everything in that journey and just doing the stuff that I like. And I like that kind of stuff. I like spoken word, weird stuff like that, peeks behind the curtain that give you little moments that show that these are human beings in a room playing music
mm-hmm.
or something that someone thought of. For example, like a spoken word example, I listened to y'all's episode with Carolyn Kendrick, and there's a bunch of spoken word on that record, and it's really unique and weird. And I think that's what makes it cool. And there was a lot of thought put into it. I think it just shows intention, and I like that.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I think we're coming up to a time where that feels more important to people. I have a theory on like, you know, the romanticism of things you can touch and see and feel like in audio recordings even. And like, when you think of what was that big Doechii single that blew up last year? Like you don't see hopefully we're about to enter a new era of rap skits and voicemails and souvenirs of real people.
I agree. Rap skits are such a long, awesome tradition that I'd like to see more of, you know, and maybe even integrated into other genres. You know, I think it's sort of a hip hop tradition that's a lot of fun. Growing up in Houston, you know, hip hop music was a thing. I wasn't a huge hip hop fan, but I definitely had a fair dose of it. But I just feel like people are looking for more interesting things. You can't just put out the music anymore, maybe. And maybe that's frustrating. Maybe that's a thing that can be annoying as an artist. But if you like to make stuff, then just make stuff. And make more of it, I guess. You know, that's the way I
period.
Look at it.
Period. Make things. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't want to forget to ask you about this question about Amen. So the opening track of your first album, it's a big swing because Amen is like, that's what we all say when we agree. And you're asking some big questions with irreverence. So I guess, do you have a spiritual practice? And are you bringing humor to your, like, why is humor important in terms of asking the big questions about life and death?
I don't have a specific spiritual practice, but I think that, I mean, I do, you know, I do yoga and stuff. So I do feel connected to something, I guess. And that's not just because of the yoga, but just by feeling small and feeling, in a sense, you know, experimenting with certain, I mean, you know, like a lot of people have started doing psychedelics and things like that. I definitely feel small and insignificant. And that makes me feel connected to something in a weird way, connected to something that I can't control. And it is very cheesy and cliche but it's true that I think it's a little bit, I think we're too small to say that there's nothing, you know,
mm-hmm.
out there, maybe. We just don't know. So I guess that's the best way I can answer the spiritual question. I've never really been asked that, and I still don't really know the answer to it. But I don't practice a specific religion or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up Catholic, and I feel connected somewhat to Catholicism just because that's how I grew up and everything. But not really, you know, I'm not a practicing Catholic at all. And humor, to me, I mean, I think it's, again, another sort of cliche and obvious thing. It's just, as someone who's been through a lot of difficult things, and had it really easy in a lot of ways too. I think humor is just something that exists in just about not every situation, but you can find light and humor and in places after you've fully felt the darkness, if it's a tough situation. You know what I mean? I think that humor can be a really good thing if you haven't blocked out the difficult part of whatever the situation may be. And yes, I'm always trying to find humorous ways to express certain things. But I don't want to make them too obvious. You know, they're more like little Easter eggs.
When did you become a parent?
4 years ago next week.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been great. I love it.
How does being a father change who you are when you're out in the world playing music?
Just makes me miss home a lot more than I already did, especially when your kid is young. If you're gone for too long, it feels way longer to them than it does to you, even when it's a long time. So everything's bigger in their world. You know, 2 days feels like a long time to them. You know, you may remember being a kid and being like thinking about how long it's going to be until school's out or something. You know, everything feels long. So that's kind of constantly in the back of my mind, is just if I'm traveling, and not just her, like I want to be home to be with my wife as well. And keep nurturing this little world that we've all built together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the question is more like, how hasn't it changed who I am in the world? And I hate to be too obvious about it because everyone says it, but it is true. It's every little perspective is just slightly different now.
Mm-hmm. Do you sing with your daughter a lot?
She's getting there. She sings in tune. I kind of can't believe it. When she was not even a year and a half old and was, or she was even younger than that, like she could hum the melody to Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star in tune, and it was it's sort of inside of her. And I think a lot of kids that age before they can even speak.
Mm-hmm. I was that way. I was singing first. I think it's genetic. Tell me about the writing and arranging of Father and a Daughter.
I think it started one day here in Central Texas when we had a big freeze. There was all the oak trees were getting really heavy under this ice that had formed. It was sort of a sleet rain thing happening, and it was like 5 degrees, which doesn't happen that much. So all the limbs were weighing down and breaking and falling to the ground from really high up. It sounded like shotguns and bombs going off. But my daughter and I were in our backyard, and she just wanted to be outside. She didn't care how cold it was. Kids love to be outside. And we were just playing outside, and these limbs were falling to the ground, and it was freaking me out. I was like trying to keep her out from underneath all the trees. And eventually I got too cold. I was like, we got to go inside. But that was, that's kind of how the first verse came about. And there was a song I wrote many years ago that wasn't very good that I stole a few lines from. I keep every song I write. I don't write that many, like I said, but even the ones that aren't very good, I still keep filed away because I think I've been doing it long enough now to where there's good stuff in them, and I'll steal from them later.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of stuff comes back. What format do you save your snippets in?
A really horrible, unorganized hodgepodge of voice memos and Google Docs, and then a couple of notebooks full of scribbles that don't make any sense. I'm the most I am not organized in my creative process at all. I don't even know what it is. It's a mess, but when something strikes me, I try to strike back and go with it as hard as I can, you know, because I'm not real scheduled. Although I've had to be more so since I've had a family. That is one thing I've gotten a little better about, is trying to do more, even if I don't feel like it, because I've a lot less time.
Yeah. And it's like, I don't really believe there's one better or worse way. I think the capitalist Protestant work ethic makes a lot of people think they need to get up every day at 6 and do it. And it's like, if your life demands that, then do that. But I think there are a lot of us for whom we naturally move on different cycles, and there's nothing wrong with that.
No, I think there should be more books written about that style.
Yeah.
Because I don't read songwriting books. I've read a few. I'm not against it by any means. But the few that I've read, I'm like, well, shit, I'm not doing any of this stuff. Does that mean my songs suck? And I don't think they do.
No.
And also, like, I've gotten plenty of good tips out of those about, you know, clearing your head, ways to clear your head of stuff and everything.
Sure.
But the one of the consistent themes I've seen is like, yeah, you got to write something every day. You got to put something pen to paper every day. And I don't think that's correct. I don't think that's the only right way to do it. So I agree with you completely.
I think if you're a songwriter, you're going to write songs. And if you need advice, it should just be about how to get out of your own way, get organized, you know, edit. Like, I do think there is some of it. There's a lot of it that's just hard work, but you can't teach someone to want to write songs.
For sure.
You have to be obsessed with it. That's only one woman's belief, but I think you have to need to do it.
I think you can teach people to do it. I don't think you can teach people to do it well, you know?
Right.
I think that I agree with you. You kind of have to be obsessed with it. I'm obsessed with it in a sense. I don't even like doing it sometimes. And I hate to say that, you know?
Right. Who does? It's still a job. It's like something you have to do to get something out in the world.
Yeah. And it's very satisfying though. And I've learned a lot from it because when something does work out and it's something I enjoy and can get behind and am proud of, it feels really satisfying. Feels like I worked hard, you know?
Let's talk about the cover of your new album. What happened and are you okay? And why do you, Tony Camel, condone violence?
Well, I'm okay. I was accosted and beat up by a makeup artist.
And charges will be brought, and there will be justice and accountability for that.
Yeah. I mean this figuratively and metaphorically, but life is violent. Things are hard. And there's a quote that cover represents, which for those of you who haven't seen it and are listening, it's a picture of me who beat up with bloody lip, bloody nose, but I have a smile on my face. And that comes from my grandmother. My grandmother and I were really close, and our family went through some really tough times when my dad got sick and passed away, and then some other stuff happened. But she told me, eventually life starts to knock you around. You've got to be ready to fight with a smile. And that really stuck with me. And then as those difficult times continued, I noticed when she wasn't breaking down and she was consoling us, she'd have this little smile on her face. And then that quote would come back in my head. Then she passed away. And so that just always stuck with me. And as I was writing these songs, I noticed a lot of them were about little difficult times in life. And I wanted to express them in a positive light. It's supposed to be an uplifting record. And the idea is when you get into those difficult situations, you're not supposed to run from the darkness and run from the fight. You feel all that as much as you can. And then when a light starts to appear, then you walk towards the light. So it's not like I'm not trying to express some sort of toxic positivity situation, but that's the basic aspect of it. So I've been sort of fearful of being too artistically expressive. And I thought that the idea for that cover was a little risky, but then honestly, nothing really matters in this whole thing. It's like, do whatever you want. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be more expressive artistically in the cover as well. And I'm glad we did that. I had fun doing the photo shoot, and I think it kind of, like I talked about before, I like to try to tie things up in a bow and make them fit together and stuff like that.
It sounds like you have a really clear intention for what you want your music to do for people. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think so. I've never been asked that. That's a good question, Lizzie.
Oh, thank you.
I think in this case, I didn't even think about other people until it started coming together. I didn't really think about how some of this stuff may help other people until it came together. Because I've realized at one point, like, you don't really get to choose how people interpret your music. So if I intended to do something, inevitably someone would find some other way to use it. Even, you know, I don't get to choose how it helps them or hurts them or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to keep that out of my mind. But as things were coming together, I sort of cautiously hoped that this record would be a lift for people that are going through difficult times and give them some strength to fight, I guess. You know, I didn't necessarily start off that way, but I always hope that people have positive experiences with the stuff I make, and that's no different in this case.
Mm-hmm. It's felt. Where do we hear Austin on this record?
I don't think you do very much on this record. If I think through it, I tend to write more about, on the first record, you hear a lot of Gulf Coast.
Yeah.
I grew up in Houston, and that's near, it's just a not far at all from the water. And I grew up going down there all the time, grew up swimming in that dirty water. So you get sort of a sense of place in that first record way more so than this one. And, you know, I don't write a lot about Austin necessarily, but, or Central Texas, like a lot of, I think, traditionally a lot of Texas-based songwriters do.
Mm-hmm.
But so I guess you don't hear it in this record. Now, I guess that just might be the answer to your question.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's definitely a shift. And I was curious, like, what's local and what's a journey? We'll have to listen back with that in mind.
Yeah. I don't know. I do write about real experiences. And I guess the only way you can hear Austin in this record is that a lot of these experiences happened here, namely the ones with my daughter. And that's about it, really. I will say, okay, here's one spot is in A Father and a Daughter. Where I talk about live oak trees and this, the area of Austin. I'm outside of Austin in Dripping Springs, Texas, and it's just covered in big live oak trees, and they're really pretty in my opinion. So I think you can hear it in that moment.
Now, what excites you about folk music right now? Who should we be listening to?
Good question. I think folk music is always exciting because it's, in a lot of cases, it's current.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I don't know. I don't know what exactly excites me about folk music that didn't excite me from the beginning, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think good writing is good writing, whether it's folk music or anything else. I really liked the Carolyn Kendrick record, although I think it's one of those records that can be, it's really a risky subject matter. But I like it because it's real and it's something that she was in the middle of researching and going through. One of my favorite songwriters here in town is a guy named Silas Lowe.
Mm-hmm.
He should be more well-known, in my opinion. He's got a really good record out called Wandering Father, Forgotten Son. It's several years old, but his dad abandoned him, but they rekindled their relationship later. And he was a songwriter too. So half of those songs are his songs and half of them are his dad's songs.
Oh, wow.
So that's so sort of a reckoning of their relationship in song mm-hmm. form, which I think is a pretty strong thing. I like the Deslons a lot and they're
the best.
They're so good. And Riley Downing, one of the members of that band has a solo record out that I think is just fantastic. And then my most current songwriting hero is Dan Reeder.
Mm-hmm.
Who I discovered 4 or 5 years ago. And the reason he's such a big hero of mine is because he does whatever he wants. He writes about all this funny stuff. And then also here in Austin, a fiddler named Beth Grisman, who I just love. And she and Silas.
Grisman with a G?
No, C-C-C-H-R-I-S. Critically. Yeah, exactly. Grisman. I'm a big fan of hers as well.
Okay, these are great recommendations. Thanks for doing my job.
And one more thing is Melissa Carper. If you like country music.
Oh, she's so great.
Yeah, she's. I've known her a long time. And I just think she's just one of the best, truly.
She's really special.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Riley Downing taught me how to two-step. I got to give him the shout out on the pod. Thanks,
really?
Riley, for putting me on. Okay, will you do a lightning round? Don't think too hard, just blurt it out.
Okay. Sure.
Who's your favorite author?
Well, I'm going to go with I'm going to go with Larry McMurtry.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite summer beverage?
Sparkling water.
Which animal will you be in your next life? Not want to be. Which animal will you be in your next life?
A hippo.
What's your least favorite household chore?
Changing diapers.
Rough.
Mm-hmm.
God bless. What's one instrument you wish you knew how to play?
Piano.
Are there any instruments or sounds you will never hear on a Tony Kamel record?
Nope.
If you could be Olympic level proficient at any sport, what would it be?
Golf.
What's the perfect age to be?
40.
And finally, what is one song you wish you had written?
I wish I had written, man, that's the hardest question you asked me in this lightning round for sure.
Well, we got you warmed up, you know, you warmed up with the easy beverage thing.
Yeah.
Golf.
Yeah. I'm going to go Everybody Hurts by R.E.M. I don't know why. I've just been liking that song lately.
It's a perfect song.
It's a good one.
Recording here in Georgia. This was a great interview. Thank you so much for talking with me. Everybody go get We're All Gonna Live. It's a beautiful, beautiful album with a real get up and go vibe.
Thanks, Lizzie. I'm a big fan and I really enjoyed meeting you. And thanks so much to Bluegrass Situation. The Basic Folk podcast is awesome.
Thank you so much.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by Anthony Cabrera. Dietrich Strauss composes our music. Basic Folk is a production of The Bluegrass Situation. You can find all of our episodes there. You can check us out on basicfolk.com, folkalley.com, or Folk Alley's mobile app. You can also search for Basic Folk on SiriusXM's app, or you can listen wherever you get your shows.
Send this episode to your crush, you coward.
Ha 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 ha. All right.
We love you.
We love you. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Bye.